There was loads of people in recruiting going to it. Katrina Hutchinson O'Neill was there. There was, I think, Bill Bowman sort of watched it. So there's actually loads of people actually turned up to watch the fight. So, yeah, it must have been a good occasion if the fight itself wasn't maybe the most thrilling thing to ever see.
The fight, it looked like, I don't know, if you and I, like, I don't know, were like play fighting or something. That's what it looked like. It didn't look like a proper... But I mean, they were like mates in the press conference and everything. It was not, it was such a letdown compared to like Wilder. You know?
Yeah, it's because it's a massive mismatch though. I mean, with all due respect to Dillian White, he's definitely not ever going to be competitive against Tyson Fury, is he? So,
well, I mean, that went to prove it, didn't it? However, I still thought, he was going to be a lot better than he was. I thought he was going to be better than Wilder. I still think he would probably batter Wilder, to be honest, but...
No, you won't.
Well,
that's a conversation for another time. But but anyway, we're live, everybody. It's Bring Food Live on air. We're back in the UK time. I'm bringing it to you every Friday, as we always do. And I need to firstly apologize to all of our American friends who have been apparently setting an alarm like 2 hours ago in order to watch this show. It's obviously some sort of snafu that I made when I was trying to book this event and schedule it. I was doing it from Australia, no excuse, but basically I might have put it 2 hours earlier than now, in which case loads of people getting up ridiculously early to watch this. So I beg your pardon. I apologize. I hope that's okay. Anyway, we are going to have a really interesting conversation today. This is a show I've been trying to do for a long time. Ever since I started to see this chief people officer role start to emerge, what is the position? Why is it different from HRD? Is it the same thing with a rebrand? How do you actually get to this position? And we're going to talk to a few of our industry friends who have recently moved into a CPO position for the first time. And our view is, can we learn from them in terms of how they got there? What are the steps you need to reach this position? So it's going to be really interesting, a really interesting show. Anyway, before we kick off, just a quick couple of basic housekeeping stuff with audio and visual. Crowdcast folks, if you're in here and you can hear me okay, can you please just let me know that the audio is fine? I think I can see people on chat, but just confirm you can hear me okay. We should be blasting this out on LinkedIn as well. LinkedIn Live, folks, are you there? Let me know if you are. Give me a thumbs up or something, and let me know whether the audio is fine there. We should also be blasting this out on the Facebook group and on Twitter as well. So if you're in those places, let me know whether you're going to be good, whether we're good to go in those spaces as well. Okay, cool. Quick word to our sponsors. As ever, this show cannot happen without our sponsors. So please spend a bit of time to check them out. Every single week, we have somebody stepping up and saying, yes, they're going to support the show. This week is one of our good friends from the UK, Zinc Work. This is a really interesting automated reference and background checking business based on blockchain. I think one of the obvious ways in which blockchain might work is in terms of ID verification and kind of verifying sort of the work someone's done. So it's great to see a UK business build their service around this. If you haven't got any kind of automated referencing system or background checking system, you could do worse than check out Zinc.work. So I've shared the link in the chat stream there. Make sure you check it out. Let's get on with the show. Welcome back to Adam Gordon. Adam Gordon, I think the last time we spoke to you, you were the CEO of Candidate ID. You are now some senior exec at ISIS. So I guess congratulations on all of that business. And, you know, hopefully the world of working in a bigger tech company is suiting you well, mate.
Yeah, thanks very much. Actually, last time I was on, I was already, I had already transferred, but you can congratulate me again, and that's all right. Interesting, though, a few weeks in. Interesting. I'll tell you the most interesting thing is the creature comforts that you get in a big company, all the technology and tools. You know, you get when you get a bank holiday, you can actually take it off. All the different groups of people. I mean, our sales team, for example, which was really Scott, myself, and latterly Lauren, Scott, myself, and Lauren. I mean, we were doing the job of what is in a much bigger tech company is like six different teams doing all the stuff that we were doing in customer success. I mean, our customer success team was doing the job of probably 8 different, you know, iSIMS teams. So it's very exciting. Very exciting time. The difference between running a startup company and clearly what it takes to become, you know, a senior executive in a large organization is such a different mindset. I mean, I kind of knew that already, but, you know, 4 weeks in and seeing it firsthand is really, really exciting.
Yeah, I think so. I think your prior experience in some big corporate businesses probably helps, right? So you're not one of these that have only worked in small and then gone big. You've worked for big companies. You've had some ideas that, you know, how these big machines work. So that probably helps. Although iSIMS are probably in between size-wise, aren't they? They're sort of not a PwC monster, but obviously significantly bigger than Canada ID as well. So, you know, it's a happy medium, I guess.
Yeah, like 1,300 people. So when I was at PwC, that was 125,000. I think it's a lot bigger now as well. But 1,300 people compared to what we had was 21 or 22. So yes, obviously that's a big difference. But and I didn't start Candidate ID from, like, I didn't drop out of Stanford and then start it in my mate's garage. I did have 10 years of working for other people before I started working for myself. So you're right. I did have some experience of that, but things have changed a lot. I last worked for a big corporate in 2007. So things have changed a huge amount in terms of what you can expect. And the onboarding experience just alone has been, you know, so well thought out, all the different aspects of it. Onboarding's come on considerably since I joined PwC and was taken to the pub for about 8 pints on my first day. That's what my manager did. He took me to a pub off Baker Street called The Beehive, and we had about 8 pints each, and then he said, right, see you tomorrow.
Well, that's where you've broken in then, I guess, isn't it? So, very, very interesting. Anyway, well, it's actually worth the show. We should talk about it in some of the content. As I think I mentioned to you before, there's a few people I know now, who friends of mine, who've now, you know, companies have been acquired. They've actually, you know, won the thing, basically got to where they are. And it's like, okay, what next? I mean, it's quite interesting to have a chat with those folks and say, what is next? How do you handle it mentally? What are the plans? Are you checking out? Are you checking in? You know, what kind of things need to happen? So it could be something worth doing at some other point. Anyway, let's get on with the show. Do you even have time to read Recruiting Brain Food now? I mean, is your day busier, or do you have time to read the newsletter?
The only two things that would stop me reading Brain Food were if I had to take my kid to the hospital or if I had a rugby match. Everything else is out the window for Brain Food. So let's get on with it. I liked Amazon's new CEO, Circus, is that his name?
Andy Jassy, yeah.
Jassy, sorry, yeah. His shareholder letter was great. However, the bit I enjoyed most was the reprint of Jeff Bezos's first shareholder letter in 1997. And it talked in there about, we over-index on hiring builders. We want to hire people who know that launch is just the start. Launch is not the finish. We want experimenters. We want tinkerers. We want people who constantly ask, why can't it be done? And, you know, I thought that was really interesting because I very much doubt that Amazon really over-indexes on that anymore. Because, I mean, they will hire a certain amount of people like that, but it can't be like everybody like it would have been back then. So really interesting article. Interesting to see the differences between the two letters, but also the similarities actually as well.
Yep, I think so. I mean, it's obviously one of the hardest things you might want to have to do to follow Jeff Bezos, someone like that. I mean, especially with one of the iconic Bezos moments, which is to write the annual letter, which has become basically an institution, really, since Bezos was there. But Andy Jassy did a really good job, and he actually talked a lot about recruiting towards the latter third of the letter. He actually gave you 7 tips as to what to do if you're going to hire, what his sort of recruitment heuristics are. And I thought they were all really useful to have a think about. I think it's just great to have CEOs think about hiring in this way, you know, to have it as a big component of what they do. It's not just looking at bottom lines or top lines or whatnot, but looking at the people that are building this. So I think that is a message that Bezos had, and he's carried through with his successor Andy Jassy. And I think it's a really good thing to read. So I've shared it in the chat stream there. So check it out and make sure you set yourself 2-3 minutes worth of time and go through that. It's a really well written letter. Okay, what else, Adam?
The purpose of purpose. I think that this was an article in Strategy Magazine, something like that. And it's one of the things that we often think about employer branding in our industry. We often think about employer branding in terms of, okay, how can we highlight the benefits best? And how can we highlight, you know, the office environment? And how can we highlight the career progression opportunities and things like that? I really believe that we often miss out on what's probably the most important thing, which is, what is that organization actually trying to achieve? What's its goal? What's its products? Who does it serve? What good is it trying to do for the world and all that type of thing? And so, you know, purpose is something that we should be bringing out in employer brand a lot more. And the only organizations that really do it are those organizations that are truly, they've probably got a founder who is truly purpose led, and those like cult type organizations, like maybe WeWork used to be, or like Tom's, for example, those types of organizations, they're the ones that bring out purpose and employer brand, but not nearly enough of us do. And on a side note, I think it's really important as individuals that we all have purpose as well, because the amount of people I've seen who they get to the end of their career and they retire, and then they just kind of they lose all their zest. And, you know, a lot of people do that because they don't have any purpose now that they've finished work. So if you make your career your purpose, that's going to cause you a problem when you retire. And so, you know, personal purpose, I think, is really vital as well. In fact, people keep saying to me, so what are you doing next? When are you heading off into the sunset? And I'm like, I'm 45 years old. My purpose is to try and make recruitment better for humanity. I'm going nowhere. I'm staying to do that. That is my purpose. So, you know, I think humans need purpose as well. So the company thing, the link to the employer brand, we need to bring that out a lot more. But as humans, we need to really think about what's our purpose as well.
I think that's right and true, but I think it's also okay to be slightly purposeless. I remember someone asked me this question in Australia, actually, and it was it was a fine question, but it was kind of like quite direct, given the fact I had hardly known this lady, and she just said, "Hung, what is your purpose?" And she was like, "I can tell you, she was profoundly dissatisfied with my non-answer to that question." Because I had to tell her I didn't really have a purpose. You know, I think it's all pretty pointless. You know, I do believe there's no purpose in life generally. We're just the biological beings, but that simply happen to be, and one day will happen not to be. And I guess what I'm trying to do is just simply, you know, have a bit of fun doing it, you know, go kind of forward with a very exploratory attitude to the world that's out there, and just try and see whether you can do something interesting or positive with it. So, you know, I don't say I would have like a fixed purpose to go and do something great. That's definitely not the case. And I just wonder whether that's okay, because there's got to be a lot of people floating around there, maybe thinking, oh, you know, I'm just kind of, you know, getting by. And I wouldn't want them to feel necessarily bad about the fact they don't have a grandiose purpose to align themselves to. And in fact, before you interject on this, the purpose of the purpose, which is this post, they're saying that the only way in which it works is if it is truly aligned with what it is. So in other words, you can't fake it. You know, if you're a business that's out there purely to make money, that is your purpose,
yeah,
that should be okay. And that needs to be clearly stated. So the worst thing you can do is then start layering on some of the, you know, BS that isn't the case of what it is that you do. And I think maybe one way in which we could kind of sit more happily with the idea of purpose is to kind of take away the normative aspects of it. So we're not saying anything. It's possible to have any kind of purpose, good or bad. It's not a value statement. It's simply a statement of what is the driving force behind your activities. So anyway, that's a small anecdote, which I failed to finish the story on, but there you go.
Yeah, no, I get your point, but you're being purposeful about having no specific purpose. So, you know, I don't mean to sound contrarian here, but you're actively choosing not to go for a specific thing. I think my point is that you know that you have the choice to do that. A lot of people just go through life and they don't even really think about it.
All right, yeah, that's a different thing. I've thought about it and I think I'm satisfied with my inability to answer it. But I think you're right. A lot of people simply don't even have a thought about it and they're just kind of churning through and without any awareness. That probably is not positive because, as you say, with the retirees, I've seen it myself, the retirees often then just drift. And I think that's basically... accelerator to an early finish on this planet, to be honest with you, because
on that, I mean, I recall when I worked at PwC, I recall somebody telling me the average life expectancy of a PwC partner was something ridiculous. It was way less than 70 because it was 60. It was like 66 or something like that. And the reason for that was, I mean, this is probably different now. I remember they used to do partner boot camps and stuff like that, which was all about,
it's probably got something to do with eight pints a day culture.
That was a business development director. That wasn't a partner in the firm. No, the partners weren't quite like that. But typically, I think typically a lot of them, their purpose was being a partner at PwC. And it would have been the same back then. I mean, we're talking about the 2000s. Life's different now. It would have been the same. It's not a PwC thing. I think it would have been the same across all of the big four. But, you know, those high, and it will be the same across like Magic Circle law firms and Goldman Sachs and these really high octane sort of professional environments. But I was quite shocked when I heard that back at that time.
It's a very low number. And I think you're right, because the partnership model that is the thing to achieve. You know, once you've hit that, then essentially you've got it made. There's no question that's the case. And there's so much competitive energy towards those limited positions because it is a zero-sum game that it can be all-consuming. I'm very, very glad I'm not in that position, because I don't think I'd go out of two ways. I'd be like extremely vicious and compete, do anything I could do to get there. I think I could go that way. Or I would just check out and just say, listen, this game's not for me.
It wasn't for me.
Yeah, it's not for me, mate. That's not how I do it. Anyway, one more, mate, before we get on with the show.
Oh, right. I've got three. Let's do one more. Okay, so... I mean, I almost always talk about working from home and, you know, the return to the office and things like that. So I'll do this one. It was good. Good Hire, which I think is owned by Checker. They did a survey of hiring managers, and they found that surprisingly, 75% of managers say that some in-person work is definitely preferred, but at the same time, only 27% of them thought that productivity or engagement had worsened since the start of the pandemic. So most of them thought that productivity and engagement was the same or better, but still most of them want some kind of in-person, you know, working. And then the other statistic, which I thought was quite remarkable,
Before you say that, what's your theory on that discrepancy?
Well, it hasn't become conscious to them that actually life's better working from home.
Right. Okay.
I think they think it is probably because of their training or something like that. Mm-hmm. But actually, subconsciously, what they haven't realized, or consciously, what they haven't realized is actually things in most cases are better. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a personal statement from me, by the way. I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I'm just saying that I think that's why there's that discrepancy. But then the one other stat which really stood out was 24% said they did not expect full-time return to the office this year, 2022. Hang on. So 76% said they expect full-time return to the office this year. That is quite remarkable. I'm surprised. I'm very surprised that many people think that that's going to be happening. Because I don't think it will. It won't happen like on that scale. And I think that's absolutely the wrong thing to do as well. So interested to know what you think.
I think that managers have got no role to play in a remote first world. I think it's fundamentally an on-premise fault role. The value of a manager is to sit there and intimidate the workers to get busy with work. That's the primary value of there being a manager. Now, if you're remote work, I'm saying that you are trusting your team to self-direct and self-monitor and self-do whatever. You've got technology to help you kind of track output and track activity anyway. I fail to see what a manager's doing. There's a role for someone who's a coach, a personal development guy, someone who might be an emotional support person, maybe a career development type of individual. Manager, no role. Shouldn't exist in the remote first world.
It's interesting because it actually does tie in with one of the other Brain Food articles that I saw from Make Work Better. And the guy said there's a 71% productivity uplift if you can assign 2 full days every week for no meetings in an organization. Yep. Mm-hmm. So it's the difference. It's the concept of high trust companies and low trust companies, I guess. So if you are a high trust company, however, what you probably need is that the individual contributor's work has to clearly have like milestones and input. Nobody can hide in that type of environment. But I wouldn't agree with what you said about the manager's like purpose is to intimidate the workers into doing their work. I think a manager's purpose in an organizational structure is to protect their team from having to deal with a load of information that they don't need and to cascade appropriately. So I think the manager purpose is a communication purpose more so than an intimidation purpose. But I understand maybe could be to do with your professional experience where you get that sort of notion.
All my managers were amazing. They really were. But because they had the higher fire kind of power, inevitably, even the nicest person will have intimidation factor. So I think what will happen is that you're going to have to get rid of higher fire responsibility from managers. Boom, that disappears the manager altogether. They become coaches. And then suddenly we're all self-directed. We get fired by algorithm, perhaps, because our performance isn't good enough. So it would be much fairer, but we'll do less of this needing to pretend that a manager's not what the manager's doing. Now, I think you're right when you talk about the nature of the work, the tangibility of the output. Because if it is intangible output, then yes, probably it's more going to be a case where it's hard to assess whether someone's performing well. Whereas if it's tangible output, or you choose only to judge people on tangible output, then I think the role of the manager would decrease and whatnot. Anyway, this is a topic for another Brain Food Live. I've been just struggling for topics actually recently.
It's a big one.
Now, talking to you just 10 minutes has given me a couple more already. So we'll definitely talk about the role of the manager in the remote first world. And I'll happy to stick my neck out with this marginal position and see whether people have a problem with it. Let's get on with the show. Let's bring on our guest. I've been waiting along a little bit too long. Before I do that, actually, let me ask you the question. CPO, when did you first came across this term? Because it didn't exist a couple of years ago. So when did this happen for you?
Oh, I think it did. I think it was... I reckon the first time I heard that job title might have been 10 years ago, but really? I think it only became common 5 years ago, 6 years ago. I mean, it basically means HR director, doesn't it? Is it not the same thing?
I've run a poll down at the bottom here, and there are 8 votes to say it's a new name for HRD, and then the 7 votes to say actually it's a new role. and they know what it is. And then five votes that say it's a new role, but they don't know what it is. So I think here's what we're going to do. We're going to ask the guests to come on, and they can tell us whether it is the same as the HRD, if it's different, then why? And then they can bring it on from there. So I'm going to bring on...
The main difference, I think, is that human resources is a hotly debated term as to some people think it's crass, right? Because it's treating the humans as a commodity by just the nature of the term, human resources. You are a resource.
So you're very keen on the idea that it's just a rebrand, right?
Everything needs to be marketed in the way that it's intended. And if it's not intended that the humans are a resource, then that's probably not the right term. And people is a big enough term that it's got the scope to go in lots of different directions and be flexible and adaptable. But the other thing is, it is a chief role which elevates it to the status of the chief marketing officer or the chief financial officer, for example. So, I think that was also an important thing, because that function has to be as important as every other, in my view.
Maybe it's a status upgrade. Who knows? Well, let's ask some people who might know. We have Layla Kidwhite to join us here. Layla, great to see you. It's been a little while. Actually, not so long, because we spoke, 2 months or so ago, which was like, a thrilling moment after like a 5-year hiatus. So anyway, great to see you, Layla. Can you hear us okay? And can you say something and let us know we can hear you?
Yeah. Hey, nice to see you. I'm assuming you can hear me.
We can hear you. Great. Can you introduce yourself? Who are you? What it is you do?
I'm Layla. Just aside from not having spoken to Hung for the last 5 years, I am, a people leader, as you would call it. I've been in multiple different roles in various startups over my career. I don't know if I've had a CPO role, but I definitely have opinions on the matter. So because I have sort of been in roles where you kind of report into founders or the leadership team. So happy to shed some light into that. And also I'll be officially taking on that title in a week or so, so I can shed some light on what I plan to do with that role.
Yeah, so super exciting. Congratulations to Layla, firstly, for getting a CPO role. So round of applause for Layla Kidwhite. and the reason why I wanted to bring you on is because you are it's kind of a newly hatched CPO. So this is like are you okay there, Leslie?
No, I just spoiled water, but it's fine. I'll fix it later.
If you need to go to the bathroom, get a towel, man, go ahead and sort that.
Yeah, okay. No worries. All good.
Yeah, no worries. Okay, so Leslie Kivett is here with us today. Leslie, can you introduce yourself? Who are you? What it is you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Leslie Kivett. I'm the founder of a company called The People Lab, based out of Switzerland, actually, nowadays, where I predominantly help Series A up to D companies building and accelerating their people strategies. So this varies actually a lot from, from building HR fundamentals to people functions to building TA strategies or basically day-to-day management. And in a previous life, I worked for a bunch of corporates, worked for a bunch of larger tech companies. And for the last couple of years, mostly been focusing on helping startups.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. And actually, Leslie, you've got an amazing CV. Like, you've worked for people like Meta, haven't you? You've worked for Oculus, and you've actually been CPO multiple times. So this is something also, the reason why I wanted to bring you onto the show is because you've seen it from more than one business, and that's going to be interesting to contrast. Okay, we finally got Antonio with us as well. Antonio Arias Lopez, how are you doing? Great to have you on the show. Can you introduce yourself? Who are you? What is you do, sir?
Thanks, Hung. It's an honor, pleasure to be here. Huge fan of the show since the very beginning and the brain food. I'm Antonio. I'm from Spain. I live in Germany since 10 years, with a couple of years spent at NATO in Brussels. I'm the chief people officer at Qua Intelligence. And my background is purely TA. So this is my first generalist role and my first head of HR/HRD/CPO/whatever.
Indeed, indeed. And again, congratulations on your recent move as well. So I wanted to bring people who had recently moved to this position because I think we can learn a lot from that, sort of the recency of this. The first thing we need to talk about is, what is a CPO? Is it a rebrand of HRD or is it something different? And I guess one of the ways which we could identify this is there like an existing HRD next to your CPO role? I mean, that would tell us something, wouldn't it? If it is, then maybe CPO is different. If the HRD disappears, then I'm assuming the CPO might have just absorbed those responsibilities. So how does it look like for you guys? Leila, go to you. I'm not sure whether you know too much about the company you're going to go to, at least not in the depth, because you haven't been there yet. But do you know what the difference is between the HRD and CPO expectations? And does the HRD exist in that new company?
The title exists, so I don't know exactly what the role is, but I think if I was to give you my opinion on how I would build a team under CPO, I would definitely think there's space for an HRD. I think the difference is really that we talked about purpose earlier, but I think the purpose of an HRD, or historically the title of HRD, is slightly changed, whereas now the CPO is more of it's less of a process-oriented person that's mitigating risk and liability. It's more focused on talent, like talent development, culture, and being very intentional about how you design those strategies. So I think there is still a space for someone holding that HRD title who is more focused on mitigating risk and liabilities and looking at sort of operational efficiencies and risks for the people function.
That's a really good distinction. I think the cultural piece is actually a big component of chief people officer. In fact, that the people term going into these is a fairly new term coming into this field is generally about culture, isn't it? So I think that component is really significant. Antonio, go to you. You've just taken this job. I think you've been there 6 months or so, something like that. Do you have HRD responsibilities, or is there someone else doing this job? How does it work in your business right now?
At the moment, I'm a one-man show. So I've got a few headcounts coming in the summer. I had a couple of freelancers helping out. So at the moment, I'm a jack of all trades. I do believe there's an element here, which is the seat at the table. So having a chief in there, it means that you're in equal footing with the finance department, with the information department, the technology, whoever is out there. So that was actually quite important to me to see that my CEO offered me this role with a seat at the beginning. Whether that's CHR or CPO, it meant that there's a level of trust and there's a level of importance. The investor that I met before joining told me, he still wrote it a couple of days ago on LinkedIn, you're the most important person in the company. It's like, well, we have a CEO, we have all these other very smart people, what are you talking about? But the role that people, culture, and employee experience and enablement has is critical for a company of 30 employees that's looking to get to 60.
Yeah, I totally get it. So basically, it is a status thing, but the status thing is significant because it's a big signal to the other departments that actually we're on equal footing here, and not kind of like feeding into operations or something, or feeding into finance or whatnot, which I think where HR initially emerged from finance at one point, I guess. And this is like a decisive shift away from it. Leslie, quickly to you on this question, how would you sort of separate CPO to HRD or even CHRO? I guess, is a CHRO same as a CPO in your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I actually agree with a lot of the things that Leila actually said, and actually also what was earlier mentioned also by Adam. I think it's a bit of a rebranding. At the same time, I think also a lot of companies know now that you're not going to fix problems with policies only. You actually need to build an exciting culture in order to be productive, in order to execute on your strategy. So I think that has really changed in comparison with earlier years. I think this is also part of that very big digitalization rush, right, that you had, what is it, around eight to 10 years ago. I think every company in Germany at some point was talking about digitalization. You had T-Mobile opening up startups and whatnot, right, to better understand people nowadays. So they still are. I think it's okay, they still are, yeah. You know, so I think it's probably been a piece of this. You know, to me, I think what I find really interesting about the CPO role, and I think what has changed is that specifically in the field that I operate in, is that like hiring has become, you know, so important, you know, for many companies that is, you know, that it actually opened up, I think, also doors for folks that didn't have a typical HR policy or, you know, development actually background, because hiring is basically, you know, the first thing that's on founders and, you know, mind. And because if you don't have the people, you cannot execute, you know, on larger strategies and objectives. As also being a CPO, I think is a lot about, you know, stakeholder management. It's a lot about performance, a lot about understanding, you know, business goals, and then also translating those into, you know, people. It's a much more, you know, generic role. So if I look at like a couple of, you know, the recent companies that I've worked with, indeed, most of the time I've always worked with somebody that worked on, I would call it people operations, maybe nowadays, that works more on, you know, pre-payroll, you know, contracts and all that other stuff, because you need specialized people that are extremely good at that job, because, you know, there's compliance and whatnot. I often call, you know, HR the dark side in also comparison with recruiting. And right, because you need to know things, you need to, there's law, there are rules that you need to abide to. And so there are different, you know, I would say, you know, subsets within the people space or within the HR space that, you know, sort of do require these, you know, specialists. And then there can be a CPO that oversees and I think manages all those different, you know, mini structures and actually makes sure that it's also nicely tied into, you know, business strategy. I think that's really what the role, I think, entails. It's a very long answer to your question.
Yeah, absolutely. But a thrilling one, Leslie. So don't apologize for that. Let's have a look at the topic of this show is like the career path to CPO. I want to know about what kind of skills are required or what kind of disciplines are required for you to do this job. And when did you realize some parts were missing? I mean, sometimes whenever you get promoted, there's always a component where you think, crap, I should have known, if I knew a little bit more about this area, I would actually be able to do my current job better. Do you remember what that was? And for Layla and Antonio, pretty new into it, what would you describe as being the things that have got you to that position? Layla, let's go to you first on this, actually, because obviously you haven't even started this position yet, but you did interview for it. So that was a kind of fresh in your memory and whatnot. Do you remember what kind of areas you were being assessed on when you were trying to transition from, I think it was a general, like a global TA role, wasn't it, in funding before moving to CPO? What were they looking for that was kind of a core skills and disciplines that you think got you the job?
So I think when I first made my move out of a purely TA role, I think the one thing, if I can pinpoint, that they were looking for is, do you understand what the business actually does? You know, and like not just like selling it to a candidate, but like, do you understand the business model? Do you understand our business strategy, how this aligns with sort of what we're trying to achieve? And not only knowing it, but actually having opinions on it. And so in a strange way, I feel like recruiting was probably the best path into CPO. And I will say CPO, not HRD, because being in recruiting, you actually know what teams are doing. You know, at a very, to a large extent, like very granular details of what teams are trying to achieve, what makes them tick, what their goals are. And actually, you don't know it for one team, you know it for multiple teams. And so when you really look at that level of knowledge, if you retain that, that gives you a very cool and almost a very unique perspective on what's going on in the business. And so transitioning into a leadership role, let's call it a CPO role, was really helpful, right? Because you understand what teams are doing, you can have an opinion on it. So I would say that having opinions on business strategy is the thing.
two really interesting insights there. Number one, when people say, do you know what the business does? I think most people say yes, but the second point you mentioned was so important. Do you have an opinion on it? Do you have an opinion on can the business improve? That tells me that you do understand what the business is and you can critique it. So that is a level, I think, above most recruiters, I would say. Simply because recruiters are trained to take the marketing message and pitch it. And generally speaking, that's the level of depth that they need in order to do their job. Are they in a position to actually examine the business processes and start sort of feeding back to it? So I guess people listening to this, you want to move into this type of leadership CPO type position at some point. Have that level of depth of knowledge about the business. And second thing you mentioned really interesting, Leila, was the recruiters have a unique insight into the business, maybe more so than most, because you might have recruited half the people doing the jobs, right? So over time, if you've gone in, let's say like Antonio has early stage 30 to 60, by the time you get to 60, you would have recruited half the business. You will have a very, very clear idea of what people do in their individual roles, what the functions are, how they mesh together and what it is. That actually puts you in a really unique, you probably know in a strange way more than even the CEO and the CFO do in terms of the operational activity of the people in the company. So recruiting may well be a very, very interesting path to take to get into this CPO position. Leslie, go to you next on this. Sort of things that you need to be a CPO, what are the kind of skills you think are required to operate effectively? And recruiters, if they're, or HR people, if they're working right now, you know, they need to start developing these skills in order to ultimately become competent at this C-level role when they get there.
Yeah, that's a very good, it's also a very broad question. I mean, if I look at myself, I think, and also the many mistakes that I made in the past, like the capability that I absolutely didn't have with anything around, HR administration and payroll and that kind of stuff. I've been an incredible cowboy, I think, during my recruiting time. So been like the typical recruiter that was fast and just wanted to hire, you know, great people, you know, regardless of the roles, and that got me in a lot of trouble during my career. And I was like, hey, if you're not willing to listen sometimes to what your bosses have to say, why don't you start your own company or become a leader if you know everything better? So that's where my focus actually went out to when I actually started to build out my career. So I think a lot of that, what supported me, I think, in moving forward was stakeholder management and building, you know, long-lasting, I think, also relationships with founders, with investors, and I guess also with, also with your team members. So I've always spent a lot of time, I think, with the teams that let you try to understand what their, you know, frustrations are, what the blockers are, so that we solve them within a short amount of time so they can actually move forward. And I think that, you know, regardless of what manager you are and what level, I think that should be your core function, I think, as a manager. And I think, you know, your focus changes. I think the complexity maybe also changes.
You know, Leslie, you said something really interesting that in terms of the first point you made with regards to the character traits of a recruiter. So we've just said, based on what Leila's mentioned, that actually a recruiter experience is great because you're going to be exposed to all of these different functions of the business. Yeah. But maybe the character traits inherent in recruiting is not so great sometimes, because we play a little bit too fast and loose with the rules in order to get placements made. And that actually is no bueno, because you're going to be in a situation where, you know, you do have compliance issues. In fact, not only compliance issues, but you're the guardian of compliance, right? It's not that easy.
Yeah, so 100% agree. But I do think, and obviously I'm biased, right? So, but I do think like the awesome benefit what recruiters have, I think above maybe the more, you know, traditional HR folks, is execution, right? So I don't think there are very few further jobs, you know, in the world where there is so much focus on executing on task, executing on strategies, on executing on make things work. And what slows companies down is a lot of strategy, a lot of talking, with very few executing. And that's is that because of
like recruiters' high pressure style?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's what helped me. And I think like some of the things that I've noticed that organizations that I supported is that I was fast. And at, for example, at a company that I supported called Sendar, I scaled the organization from 200 people to 1,000 in a year's half time. And that was not by me doing like having some, you know, some magic somewhere. It was by a lot of hard work together with the team. And, you know, you get it done. And I think where they're in maybe less, you know, digitalized organization, there's more focus on creating policies, on that kind of stuff. I think it slows the business down. Albeit, so moving, I think also to the, you know, the downside of things is that, yeah, if you don't surround yourself with folks that do know on how to think, how to keep things fair and to keep things compliant, yeah, you need those people around basically to keep, you know, the balance, right? Also within the force, because indeed, otherwise things go south. Yeah.
That's, again, really interesting insight. Adam, you about to say something?
Yeah, I'm going to ask, I'm going to make a point and then ask the guests if they would agree or disagree with my point. So I don't believe it's possible to be a chief people officer and keep up to date with the latest state of the art, like sourcing techniques and developments and things like that. So you have to presumably be prepared to go, my knowledge of what got me here is, or what got me to where, maybe to the first step or whatever it might be, I'm going to have to be prepared to let a lot of that go in order to continue to progress. Would that be fair?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm hands-on still recruiting these days, but I was actually interviewing for a sourcing position a few months ago, someone to come work for us. Actually, I spoke to someone that you, Adam, recommended, Carlo. I don't know if it rings a bell.
And, yes, it does, yeah.
And just talking to Carlo, I was like, wow, am I a dinosaur? what's all this amazing stuff he's talking about? So you need to be very conscious of where your limits are and of the stuff you need to let go. And you need to go and chase other stuff.
So my follow-up question on that would be, what do you think is the best way to educate yourself? So if you're going to go, if your kind of expert recruiting knowledge, if you're happy with the fact that it's going to potentially go out a day and dilute a bit, what's the best way to really educate yourself in business and in your business, you know, specifically in order to prepare yourself for that move?
Well, if you ask me, I was lucky. I did an executive MBA in 2017. So I was already thinking this might make sense to me. I had a really good business school near me, Frankfurt School. So I met there a bunch of other managers from completely different disciplines that kind of elevated a little bit my interest. And then it's like you said before, you have a 360 view of a business. So you're in a head of TA job, you have a 360 view of everything that's going on. And just staying connected to the departments, to me, it's critical. And one final point would be, and I made these mistakes. I think you want to talk about mistakes later on. I made the mistake of perhaps being a bit too TA egocentric. TA is, you know, the best place to be. I love TA. And, you know, payroll. Who wants to work in payroll? Why would you go and work in payroll? Well, people do, and they're excellent at it. And you know what? You need them. So you should listen to them. You should hang out with them, learn what they do, and just be curious.
I think it's very interesting that there is a kind of an internal hierarchy in the people functions, isn't there? And yeah, we may well see the administrative heavy stuff to be less interesting, less sexy, etc. Maybe that's also associated with compensation, like who gets paid more, etc. So we can't kind of deny that status competition exists within sort of the people function. But as a CPO, worst thing you can do is to denigrate these key functions that are part of your business. In fact, you need to spend more time in areas where you have a lack of knowledge, because there's no excuse as a CPO to have a lack of that knowledge. You're going to be called to represent the entire function at that board level. So yeah, absolutely, something you need to do. In terms of your personal preparation to move into this role, guys, was it ever something that you had in your mind, like, I wanted to be a CPO, this is something I wanted to do? And if that was the case, do you put into place any plans to get there? What are your thoughts on this? I'll just throw it out openly to the panel here.
I can start because this has been quite a recent thing for me. So growing up and in this profession of, or the world of people and talent, I actually never wanted to be a CPO because my perception or understanding of what that role was an HRD. And I was like, I don't care about that side of HR. And it's not even that I don't care. I will never be good at it, right? Like I don't have the personality or the mindset or even the skills, patience, let's call it that, to be good in that role. So I actually actively pursued roles that were not, you know, getting me.
You sabotage your career sort of subconsciously to avoid taking on the top job.
Yeah, exactly. So I went into TA, then I went into L&D. And I think the one thing I did do was play to my strengths. Someone told me this a long time ago. They're like, if you're like shit at something, like, okay, try and get better at it. But like, you're never going to be good at it. Like, what are your natural strengths? Stick to that and your career will make sense. And that's basically what I did, right? So I stayed in TA because I'm good at storytelling. I'm good at relationships. I'm good at some of those the fast moving deliverable things that we talked about earlier. Then I moved into L&D because I get people, right? And I was able to really understand what makes people tick, what makes teams tick. So then L&D makes sense, right? And then I sort of took on people analytics because I'm quite an analytical person, definitely not an Excel junkie. I've never have been, and actually was leading a team of people who are very, very, very good at this, right? Or like borderline data scientists. But ultimately I know what people like, data is annoying because people just throw lots of it out there. And so out of frustration, I knew that people insights, people analytics, the way to succeed in that is to simplify, right? What makes sense to the common brain. And so it was doing things like, to my summary is, I was doing things that aligned with my strengths, and strangely that allowed me to diversify and explore new areas, and then ended up allowing me to be this person that has interesting sort of backgrounds within or experiences within the HR function. And luckily today, that's what people want in a CPO, right? They don't want the
It sounds like this was an incompetent attempt to sabotage your career, Leila, because if you are saying you've gone TA, then you did L&D, and then you did people analytics, that seems to me like a pretty clear path towards CPO, doesn't it?
I would agree with that today, right? But that wasn't the path when
I think your water was dragging you towards that direction, even though maybe your conscious mind was not. But anyway, I really think that kind of like multidisciplinary experience is quite interesting. So let's take a hypothetical. A TA person has simply gone up as a TA, right? TA lead, department head, TA, TA, TA. Is that what's missing? Like, is that person going to be a good CPO, or is there like huge gaps that they need to cover? And what are those gaps particularly? We already talked about compensation and payroll. That's obviously something they should get better at. What other areas do you think they need to backfill quickly if that's the path that they've gone to? And in fact, Antonio, I believe that is your path. So, you know, I'd be interested to know whether you have any thoughts as to what areas, now that you've gone to a more generalist role, like what areas that you think, okay, I need to actually do some extra study on this.
Yeah, it's a good question. It really depends on your background. So I come into TA not from a HR studies or even business studies background. I'm a poli sci major. And there was a lot of things that I had to pick up on the way. Definitely there's a lot of alternatives for evening study, late study, blogs, brain food type newsletters and repositories that people just need to do a bit more research on. But to me, what allowed me a little bit to feel more comfortable coming into the role was having worked with really best in class HR teams. So do I have an L&D problem? I know who I can contact. I know what the major issues are. We've had conversations, coffee chats, and that's over the last 10, 15 years. So I would say that's my path.
That's actually a really important tip. I mean, how important is that tip, folks? Basically, if you have a powerful network, you've invested social capital into that network and you can call upon them when you need it, That's hugely, hugely significant. And in fact, I wonder whether companies actually need to start recruiting for people that do have strong network value, because you have to know that they're not going to know everything in themselves, but do they have a powerful enough network to call upon? Because that's part of what you buy when you hire them, isn't it? You know, when you hire Adam Gordon, you're not just hiring Adam Gordon, you're hiring everyone he knows and could potentially help him. And you know, that is actually something I'm pretty certain most companies don't measure this, but they probably should. For senior level roles and what have you, they probably should think about, you know what, who else is this person bringing to us? What networks do we acquire by hiring this person? That's actually something we should truly examine. Someone build a product on that. That should be easy build.
Is it a part of the overall ability of somebody to just get shit done? I think their network and, you know, their access to people to help bring in ideas or help solve problems is part of their overall ability to execute, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. I think that the network element is, it's also, I don't know if you want to get into this later, but how you get this type of role. I wouldn't be here on this role if it wasn't because 10 years ago, I placed a young engineer called Marco Riccardi, who is today my boss and founder, CEO of the company. And he remembered me, we stayed in touch. We never really were friends until recently, but that's the power of the network. Just stay in touch with folks that are at the top of their game, even if it's not even in HR, just stay connected and learn from them.
Yeah, I think that's critically important. People need to build that muscle as well. You know, you have to habituate the networking side and then make it into a subconscious habit that you do connect with people. You do kind of collect connection sort of numbers and emails. I mean, I've got like 20,000 sort of contacts in my phone, so much so that I can no longer use the contact manager here because the search breaks as soon as I try and type anything into it. There's too much data in there. So even Apple cannot create a CRM that's suitable for my network. Which actually is kind of productive because I'm screwed. That's why I don't call anybody, because I can't access any phones. But anyway, the point of the matter is you have to habitually get yourself into a position to say, you know what, every contact that's positive, that's good engagement, you know what, maybe that's something you don't let that to chance. Make sure you have that person in some sort of way you can reach back to them in some format. And that's going to help you down the road. As I think Bryce mentioned in the comments there, very interestingly, he's saying that a CEO is saying they're looking to hire someone who's already previously worked for a world-class CPO. So the idea that you build your career, you work with amazing companies and amazing people, just make sure you keep in contact with those people because they then move on to different things and what have you. And that's also going to add to your, I guess, your social proof. You know, I mean, I guess we can talk about whether that's fair or not in the long term. But at the end of the day, we do make opinions or do make judgments, especially if it's a close call between candidates, based a lot on things like social proof. Proof things that you know that increase our trust level and sense of confidence about the hire. Folks, I've realized the time. We're like literally running to the end of it. Adam, you're desperate to say something, or you're desperate to do something, so you better do it.
I've got one question which I've been I thought about 20 minutes ago, and I thought I'll save it to the end. So the route from recruitment to becoming CPO is a really interesting new development for me. I wonder, is CPO the route towards becoming CEO? So Lena Nair, who was the CPO at Unilever, just very recently joined Chanel as CEO. And I've not seen that happen very often. And her background is not running businesses and then becoming CPO. Her background was HR, it was personnel, HR, you know, organizational development. It was all people related functions, and now she's running a business, P&L, etc. Do we think that this is going to be a more regular thing that's going to happen?
I think so, and I hope it does, actually, because the war for talent isn't just in tech. It's like the workforce is changing, right? We have a very different generation now entering the workforce, which has a very different expectations of what from what they expect from a company. And so your people are going to be your biggest asset and also your big differentiator, despite what sector you're in. So having someone at the top who understands that, and not only just at a high level, but like at a more like substantial level, is massive, massive game changer and even advantage.
That's very interesting. Let's go around on this. Opinions, Leslie and Antonio, is does the existence of the role of the CPO make it easier for someone to actually get to the CEO position compared to what was happening before? Leslie, your thoughts?
I think so, yes. I think, you know, adding also to what Leila said, you know, your knowledge around OPEX and financial streams and whatnot, you can learn. You know, their MBAs basically, you know, to learn more about that. So I think so, yes. And yeah, I think also to add, yeah, I mean, talent is so, you know, it's so challenging to hire. It's so, you know, challenging also to manage with, you know, remote, you know, distributed teams and whatnot. You need a person in the organization, and that could be a CEO that truly understands like how, you know, this impacts the role. And it's interesting to see, right? Because like you already have CEOs that spend, you know, 50% of their time on hiring, yeah. Right? So that, you know, that move is, you know, will be easier, I think, over time.
That's really interesting, Leslie, because I think you're right. CEOs like to style themselves now as like they're recruiters, right? Before, I mean, yeah. I would say 20 years ago, it was like not considered to be a thing for CEOs to do. But now it's like people, people, people. So if the CEOs are starting to come towards the CPO side, CPO moving towards, maybe there's going to be increasing overlap in terms of what the role is, the changing role of CEOs. Antonio, leave it to you as a final word. You've just got the CPO in this new company. Do you see yourself dislodging the CEO at some point? What are your thoughts on this?
Jesus, he's probably listening. So absolutely, yes. No, I wanted to say something about this because Bryce in the chat has said something. He was asking about, do you see more CPOs coming from non-traditional HR backgrounds? The answer is absolutely yes. And if we then think about that next move that you, Hang, are talking about, that CEO position, if you come from an investment banking background and you're a CPO for a few years, I'm thinking about someone I know, for example, he could easily become a CEO. And also, even a more traditional HR background becoming CPO, if you think about what is the job of a CEO, the job of a CEO is not to invent a new product normally for their business. It's to lead people. It's just to get people to do stuff without having to whip them 24/7. And that's a very difficult job. Who better to do that than HR? So I'll just leave it there.
No, that's a very good finish as well, Antonio. And we'll leave it there at the end of this show. But I think you're absolutely correct. The existence of a CPO position, I think, basically will allow different types of people to come into the people operations side of the business. That, I think, is a good thing. We should definitely have weaker walls between these functions and have more talent flow across businesses as well as flow up. So anyway, thank you all for joining us on Brain Food Live today, folks. We'll let you go here. Leila Kidwai, thank you for joining us. Good luck in the new job next week. Make sure you make a big splash. Let us know how you get on, by the way. We might need to bring you back to find out what the first 100 days was like or something. That would be cool to know. But we'll see you soon, okay?
Doesn't Leila determine the first 100 days?
We'll see. She may need to redesign it. First 100 days involves 99 days in me. And
design your own first 100 days.
That's how we start our onboarding. And then I'll turn up on day 100. Okay. See you later, Leila. Yeah. Have a good weekend. Okay, Leslie, we'll have to let you go as well. Great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll certainly get you back. You've got so much to offer, loads of different things to talk about. So have a good weekend. I think everyone's got a bank holiday weekend in Europe also. So enjoy the extra days. Take it easy, my friend. And Antonio, thanks for joining the show. Great to see you. I know you're a big supporter of it. Always great to get sort of, this is a crowdcast for a reason, guys. Crowdcast, because we literally are meant to bring people from the crowd. That's how it works. So listen, congrats on a new role. And yeah, keep in touch. Keep on tweeting. Keep on supporting the show. Thank you.
Thanks.
Cool. What an interesting show, hey? Anyway, that's about it, folks. We'll let you go there. Thank you so much for watching. We are back next week. I know the schedule's not up yet, but I've more or less completed it. There's been a last-minute change of scene because guess what? We are going to be talking programmatic advertising for dummies next week. The reason why I'm bringing this to the fore is because I've realized, having tried to start a conversation on programmatic online and say, hey, what does recruitment advertising look like in the cookieless future? No recruiters had a clue. Like they literally did not know anything about it. And they're saying, yeah, do the show, Hung. I'd really be interested. So we're going to get Robin Stander back from Appcast. He's just basically going to teach us something in 60 minutes. He's going to give us a lecture on what programmatic advertising is, why it is better than what we're currently doing, why we need to move to it ASAP, and how this kind of privacy-first world future might actually impact sort of advertising in general. So follow the channel if you want to watch that show happening next week. Okay, that's about it, folks. See you next week. Cool. Well, thank you very much, Adam, for joining again. I appreciate your co-piloting as usual. Good question at the end as well, I have to say.
Yeah, it's just I've never seen it very often. I saw it a long time ago in a call center business where it wasn't the CPO, it was the HR director became the managing director. But it was a call centers business. So like the whole business, it was outsourcing. The whole business was really about, you know, people
going,
I mean, recruitment and retaining people and training people was basically the whole thing. The whole thing was that, other than the technology and the facilities and the contracts, everything else was about people. So yeah,
it is very, it's very interesting who is in poor position to lead the company. I think it's great that the CPOs will get there. I do agree there'll be an incremental increase. But I think it's still going to be marginal. It's still going to be fundamentally about what the business does. So I feel that that's still someone going to be the initial CEO of that company. And then you get like a professional CEO, right? The person who literally is brought in by investors or whatever, agnostic to function. And they would have left that history long behind. But again, something to talk about in future.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Listen, that's about it. What are you doing for the weekend? Anything interesting?
Gym. That's about it. Go to the gym. It's pretty sunny, so hopefully the weekend's going to be nice.
I'll tell you what, the weather's pissed me off. The weather's really annoyed me coming back from Australia. It's been like such a huge difference. Just landing here at 14 degrees C compared to, you know, generally 25 over there. It's like, man.
I know. However, I did just watch. It's not all great over there. Or it wasn't. I watched a documentary last night about
the flooding.
No, about basically the bashing and murder of gay people in Sydney in the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
Getting thrown off cliffs and stuff. It was pretty bad. And the police didn't care. I mean, the Sydney police are notorious. You know, I don't know whether they're still like it anymore, but they're notorious for being corrupt.
It's sad, and you know what the horrible truth is. I think we're just another victim group away from that. I mean, these days you'd never see this happen to, you know, people who are homosexual or sort of for people's different sort of sexual preferences. But I think in future there'll be some group that we think it's okay to beat up on, and you know we're closer to that than we realize.
Yeah.
Anyway,
you say we wouldn't see that today, but you live in hipster part of London. I mean, there's parts of Britain where you will see that. Absolutely, you will.
Yeah, of course. There is a metropolitan / non-metropolitan divide on general social progressivism, right?
Liberalism.
This is what the entire culture wars is all about. It's actually a regional, it's a regional war of values, you know. And it's very interesting to see how we go, because, you know, in terms of the, well, now we're going into this totally different topic, but in terms
Britain
of the
suffers from it a lot. Britain suffers from it a lot. It's because of the class system, isn't it? It's because of this old-fashioned class system.
Every country has this. You look at any, and you can see this in how people are being elected. Like, for instance, Hungary, a recent election, Viktor Orban gets in. He has no support at all in Budapest, big capital city. He's got massive support everywhere in the regions. And it's the same in any kind of political environment where you can see it through the democratic strengths of who comes forward. Metropolitan centres, generally progressive, stroke left, but then the rest of the country is generally right and nationalist, increasingly so. And
thank God France did the right thing.
Well, France have a unique system. I think if they didn't have that presidential runoff system, Macron might have been toast. If they had a more parliamentary system where, you know, people voted it less for directly for a president, I think Le Pen gets in. So small margins, man. Small margins everywhere. What can we say?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it. I got to go.
See you soon. Bye.
See you later.